And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with award-winning writer Amy Willance, the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and last year's Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She is a longtime contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. She has just returned from one of her frequent trips to Haiti. Thank you for joining us today, Amy
Thanks.
Willance.
Thank you.
So your book, The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, you chronicled the downfall of Baby Doc and its aftermath. You go to Haiti and then you come back and then suddenly he shows up there.
I have to say we never really meet because I was there for 5 days and then he left the country 25 years ago. And I'm there for 2 weeks. I leave and he comes back the next day. So I don't think we're fated to be intimates.
So the fact that there were a few hundred supporters outside his hotel, in the overall scheme of things, what does that tell us? I can't imagine that he's particularly liked in that country.
He's not particularly liked in that country at all. He's particularly disliked in that country. And my guess is from what I heard from other reporters on the ground there and when watching the tweets come through as the news was breaking is that most of the people who were there were old friends and family and friends of family who supported him and his father during the Duvalier dynasty. So that the crowd, my guess is, because it was in the hundreds and not in the thousands, was really kind of just a show of solidarity of a friendship group and a political group around him. And, you know, then maybe there was some money given out for excess people too.
Well, he's supposed to have stolen hundreds of millions, but then I understand that his hideous wife fleeced him in the French courts in their divorce.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
And he's down to, a few million, and the Swiss are holding on to $4.5 million in frozen
right.
assets.
Right, they've frozen some of his assets. But let's put it this way. He did manage to take 2 flights. That's more than most Haitian people can do. And he did manage to come into the country with a caravan of cars following him and go up and stay at the fanciest hotel now available in Haiti after the earthquake. So he's got something.
So is it possible that some of those 200 are the people – because he was a sort of dauphin when he came in. His father –
His father put his hand on his shoulder and said, he will follow me. Yeah,
For life.
For life, president yes. for life.
And when he was 19 years old.
Yeah.
And presumably there were a coterie of advisors around him for some time.
Well, yes, quite strongly there were a coterie of his father's advisors around him. But he himself, you know, has to be held responsible for the way his administration played out. I mean, he was 19 when he started. He was almost – I think he was 35 when he left power. So – it was a long time. His father had been long dead, and he has to take responsibility for the abuses of his administration. He can't simply pass them off on his father's advisors. He wasn't a baby.
Well, that was the sort of semantic cover, wasn't it? Baby Doc.
Yeah,
Papa Doc. We know from Graham Greene and other sources that what a monster he was, but it's hard to believe that the Tonton Macoute didn't from one day to the next suddenly get kinder and gentler under the baby. They were still the same Tonton Macoute, these
sunglass-wearing, pistol-packing civilian secret police, basically.
Right, who made a living through terror and extortion.
Extortion, protection money of the smallest to the largest business people so that you'd have a little market lady who sells charcoal in the market and she would have to pay taxes to the Tonton Macoute.
And so you have the Duvalier stealing at the top, and then you have this trickle-down arrangement of extortion and theft through
right.
their enforcers.
Of enforcers who, because of that, were extremely loyal to the Duvaliers.
And what happened to these people when Baby Doc disappeared?
Well, it was very violent. The people rose up against them in particular. I mean, there was an uprising against Baby Doc, but he was symbolized in every corner of the country by the Tonton Macoute. And I watched. I mean, I was there in this aftermath. The people simply went after one by one individual Tonton Macoute. I watched them uproot the Tonton Macoute who ran Pétionville up above Port-au-Prince. I went out to Cabaret and I watched them uproot the Tonton Macoute there. Sometimes they would simply kill the guy. And that was really awful. Sometimes they'd load him into the back of a truck and I don't know what would happen to them.
Again, I'm joined in the studio by author and journalist Amy Willits, who's just returned from Haiti. That sounds a little bit like, the liberation of Paris from the Nazis and the retribution against the collaborationists.
Right.
Was that the feeling?
That was the feeling, but there was also and there always is in Haiti, there's a French revolutionary feeling all the time in Haiti of, getting back at the enforcers of the nobility in a sense.
But Préval, who's not particularly popular – and he seems to be AWOL since the earthquake.
That's a big problem for him.
And he's an old colleague or friend or associate of Papa Baby Doc, isn't he?
I thought no. He's Aristide's Dauphin.
Oh, he's Aristide's Dauphin. I see.
So he comes out of the Aristide movement. He comes out of the popular movement.
Right.
He's utterly unrelated to Baby Doc, except perhaps right now because nobody understands why Baby Doc has returned to Haiti.
And that really is puzzling, isn't it? Because first of all, he wouldn't have returned just suddenly on a whim.
No,
some groundwork had to be laid, surely.
His old nickname was Baskethead because his head is so large, and so that was his nickname in Haiti, Tête Panier, and it basically means empty head also. But I say that he couldn't be so much of a baskethead as to return to Haiti without having made some kind of provision for his safety and continued freedom.
Well, one of the people who has spoken out in outrage, and his story I think is particularly powerful and really quite shocking, and that's Bobby Duval, the former soccer star.
Right.
He was starved and tortured for 17 months.
Yeah, Bobby is this guy who can never keep his mouth shut, and that was a real problem under the Duvaliers, under Baby Doc as well as Papa Doc, and he spoke out against the abuses of the government, and he was a fairly prominent figure from a very fancy family, and he was taken and he was thrown into this infamous prison in the sort of marshes by the water called Fort Dimanche, and he was left there for 19 months, and I think he weighed something like 90 pounds when he emerged from the prison, and the only reason he emerged alive from that prison was the work of Jimmy Carter and his administration, an administration that really did care about human rights, and they worked to get Bobby out of prison.
Right, and Carter since did play a role, did he not? That I remember.
He did. He was among the outside monitors who validated Aristide's election,
along with Colin Powell and. Who was the third person? I can't remember.
I can't remember, but it was a bunch of illustrious figures. Yes.
Yes. And but it always comes back. It's deja vu over again, doesn't it?
Well, for me, it's like a horrible, hideous nightmare, a return of the repressed or something to have him back there again. Right. It's as if everything I've worked for and militated for 25 years has suddenly been erased by his return.
And
it's unthinkable. Well, but anything is thinkable.
And why is that?
Well, I think that the political moment is very fragile right now. There was an election in November. Préval really tried to push one candidate of his party into the runoffs at least so that he would be one of the two final competitors and would be able to compete for the presidency. And the international community does not seem to agree that Préval's candidate was one of the two finalists. The OAS issued a preliminary report saying that, and Préval has not yet accepted that OAS report, putting him in a really difficult situation. And it was an election tainted with a lot of fraud on everybody's part. So there's this political vacuum, and then Duvalier appears like a figure from the past. It's kind of a weird moment in Haiti.
And a very popular singer was disqualified from that election.
Well,
another singer, I think, might well have won. I mean,
Wyclef Jean was not allowed to run.
Right. But then the other fellow.
And now this guy, Michel Martelly, Sweet Mickey is his nickname. Right. He is, the OAS has said, along with Madame Mirlande Maniga, a woman educator and former First Lady of Haiti, that Sweet Mickey is the other person leading in this election. But it all remains in a state of Prévalian paralysis because he has refused to say yes to the OAS report. And who knows? I just think they're not really counting votes. They're interpreting the political situation, both sides.
So what explains, as somebody that's visited this country over the years, written about it, clearly somewhere there's some affection / obsession, something that attracts you to this country. At the same time, there's this feeling of compassion fatigue about, you know, how much can we continue to care? And
well, I have no compassion fatigue. Now, Americans may have compassion fatigue.
Right.
I don't suffer from compassion fatigue, because if you go to Haiti, you don't suffer from compassion fatigue. You have a lot of compassion for these people. And this earthquake was a devastating event in a country that was already at the end of its tether in terms of poverty and in terms of penetration by globalization. This is one of the biggest problems in Haiti, is that the economy is not really in the hands of Haiti, and there's not really a local economy, and there's nothing really left for the Haitian people to work with in terms of the economy. And I think that's a gigantic problem, and it's one of the reasons that there is among older people a slight nostalgia about the Duvalier administrations, because they think that the better economy was because the Duvaliers were in power, whereas the better economy was, I believe, because globalization had not penetrated as far back then, 25 mm-hmm. years ago, as it has today.
Again, I speak with Amy Willis, author and journalist, who's just returned from Haiti. We're talking about the mysterious and extraordinary return to Haiti of the former dictator, Papa Doc Duvalier, and in general, I'm trying to figure out what, not so much why I have compassion fatigue, but why, for example, recently 60 Minutes did a piece on a year after the earthquake on all the money that went in. And I remember talking to a scholar on Pakistan who was very disturbed that Pakistan had not received anything like the international aid that Haiti did, and it translates in Pakistan to $2.30 per person, as opposed to $500 per person in Haiti. And $500 is not a lot here, but I believe it's quite a bit down there.
Well, it's twice what you would make in a year.
So what happened to that $500 per person?
It hasn't gotten to the Haitian public. It was promised. A lot of it was promised and not delivered by the international community. I mean, there was a lot of money given by average Americans and people from abroad that went to smaller non-governmental organizations and did filter into Haiti. Whether it got to actual Haitian people, I can't say, because these non-governmental organizations, some of them are very good and some of them aren't so good. So sometimes money is taken off the top or goes to cars or buildings and things that don't get to the Haitian people. But in terms of the international community, the larger givers like the U.S. and the IMF and the World Bank, that money has not even gotten into Haiti to begun to be used for various reasons. But so I don't think the Pakistanis should be so jealous. Lots has been promised, but very little has been given. Mm-hmm. I hope the Pakistanis have gotten more out of what they were promised.
Well, the 60 Minutes piece featured an aid NGO aid worker down at the airport who had all of this stuff in warehouses. I mean, tons and tons of stuff that could address the cholera problem, which was breaking out at that time. And he said that the only reason he couldn't get this stuff out of the warehouse was because he didn't have a particular stamp on this documentation. And that sort of smelled of some kind of bribe and extortion. And I couldn't for the life of me understand how all these suffering people could suffer more because of a stamp, a requirement of a stamp on a piece of paper. And you've got Bill Clinton and all these people weighing in down there. And apparently Clinton has some influence and also has a similar kind of affection that I take it you have for the country. And yet, how do you explain that? Is that the vestiges of what you call the morally repugnant elite? Do they have their fingers in everything?
It's partly that there's corruption. You're right. It's partly that the Haitians wish to have a process. You know, they want to know what's coming into their country. Mm-hmm. They want to document it. Would you advocate that the U.S. would just open up customs and say, whatever you want to bring in, bring in. We know you're people of good heart. Of course, that's cholera medication. Thanks. Mm-hmm. You know, don't fill out any forms. Just bring your container in. No, you would not accept that in America. And the Haitians don't want it. So there are two things working. There's the customary terrible corruption of la douane or customs in Haiti. And then there is this feeling we should know what's coming into the country. You got to get the right documents. And I didn't see the 60 Minutes documentary because I think I was in Haiti. But there are a lot of people who have gotten their cholera medication in. So I don't know. Did they pay protection money? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the Albert Schweitzer Hospital has to pay protection money to get its cholera medications in. They're running a very successful cholera clinic. So I don't know who those people were. But all I can say is get the stamp. Mm-hmm. Go get the stamp. Figure out how to get it. And I don't think that people should have to pay protection money to get their mm-hmm. stuff through customs, obviously.
But the morally repugnant elite that I referred to, which mm-hmm. was, I don't know. Was
the 11 families.
That was it your term? Or
I think it's a general term in Latin America.
I thought one of those families controlled the ports, that was a part of their monopoly.
Yeah, there's a family. I'm not sure they're part of the morally repugnant elite, but there is one
they
family.
They seek to join it.
Yeah, there's another strata of people who control a lot of flow and money in Haiti, which are the import-export people, and they're not always the morally repugnant elite, fancy families.
So what – and the other thing that I saw recently was during the hurricanes that happened, the flooding and the pictures of all of the refuse in the streets sort of going down to a sea and the lagoons full of detritus. It was just – shocking beyond belief, and that was led into the pieces about cholera because that was a perfect kind of petri dish for cholera. And the obviously what arises there is there any way to reverse the environmental damage? Because a lot of it's because of the deforestation, I think, that the flooding is particularly devastating.
Well, one problem is if you have no economy – and yet your economy is basically focused on urban areas, then you're running a cash economy. And to get cash, the Haitian people have been cutting down their trees. Now, they're
for
not
– for charcoal.
Yeah, to make charcoal, which charcoal is a big business in Haiti. Not only is cooking done on charcoal, which is huge, but I know this sounds ridiculous. Dry cleaning and bakeries also run on charcoal, and they use up huge amounts of charcoal. The Haitians like the dry cleaner just the way we do, so – that's where the charcoal gets used. And so their trees are going into a cash economy. And they wouldn't cut down their trees. They know what the trees do. They hold the ground in. They give you fruit. They want their trees. But it's a very practical decision.
And what could change that? I mean, because I know it feels like from the privilege of the United States, we're trying to impose, you know, Beverly Hills values on the third world.
A green revolution.
I hope you don't see me that way. But,
no.
But I'm trying to figure out how you can break this cycle.
Well, you know, I think I said to President Preval in a much earlier conversation that we had, I said, you should just say, I'm arresting anyone who cuts down a tree. And if you try to sell a charcoal bag, you can't do it. No more charcoal markets. And he said, I can't do that. They have to live. People have to live. I can't just say, suddenly, I'm arresting you. But he did say that if Haiti could somehow get its economy back and begin to cultivate rice and really have an economy that worked, an agricultural economy that worked within the country, then – you know, people wouldn't have such a need.
But wouldn't it require just a replacement for an energy source?
I mean, there are. Can I tell you about probably 200 NGOs trying to replace this energy source in Haiti? And I think they will. I mean, I think they will. But I don't think it goes to the basic problem that fueled the charcoal problem in the first place. But yeah, there are solar power. Lots of ideas for solar power. Yeah. Lots of ideas for natural gas. And there are things in the works. I don't know if they'll really be taken up by the Haitian people.
Well, I mean, for example, Hugo Chavez is single-handedly keeping Cuba going by supplying Castro with oil. I mean, do we have a Hugo Chavez on our side?
He's helping the Haitians a lot, too. He's helping the Haitians, Preval too. A huge amount, yeah.
Yeah. But
he's a bankroller for the Preval government.
You would think that, you know, just as a form of – if you're going to be giving aid, you might as well target the aid to something that could actually break the cycle of destruction.
And be sustainable. That's
and
true.
And be sustainable. But that – everything's ad hoc, is it?
There's a little bit of an ad hoc patchwork feeling in Haiti among the people who are trying to fix things.
I see.
And that's one thing that the Haitian government would like to fix if it were only capable of fixing it.
So what's just in closing then, Amy Willis, I guess we don't know what's happening here, but there is this sort of dark feeling about the emergence of this hideous person from the past that feels such an insult to the process of democracy.
It's
rubbing salt in the wound, insult from insult to injury, you know.
It is sad to have an earthquake that kills from 200 to 300,000 people, and then a cholera epidemic and a hurricane and a flood, and then Duvalier comes back. I mean, right. You have to say that's not a good sequence of events. But maybe we're just packing together all the worst possible things so that the future can be brighter. I hope that there will be some resolution of the political situation in the next few weeks.
And at this point, he says he will either stay for he's only going to stay for 3 or 4 days. That was always his plans. But he says he would like to stay there permanently.
I think he would like to stay there permanently. And today he was like charged with some crimes and has said that he will be available to justice, whatever that means.
Right. But he just had a conversation with a judge.
Of course, yeah. It's Napoleonic code down there. It's not like our law, so right. It's a little different. It's more like New Orleans law.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us in the studio.
Thanks so much
for dropping by again. I've been speaking with the award-winning writer Amy Willis, the author of The Rainy Season, Haiti Since Duvalier, and last year's Rainy Season, Haiti Then and Now. She's a long-time contributing editor at The Nation and teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at the University of California at Irvine. She has just returned from one of her frequent trips to Haiti. This has been Background Briefing. You may hear our archives and contact me at ianmasters.com and on Facebook at Ian Masters Media. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and engineer Ray Palias, and I'll be back here tomorrow at 5 for another Background Briefing. Until then, bye for now.